Behold the Sword of Power, Excalibur.
Welcome to the Oh Gosh, Oh Golly, Oh Wow podcast, the podcast where we talk about the Marvel Comics series Excalibur and nothing but Excalibur every week for 126 plus weeks. This week, we're mostly still in Germany, but sometimes back in time as Kurt Wagner remembers his blue and green mothers and defeats a demon with the queer power of love in Excalibur number 77, Lowest Common Denominator. Excalibur 77 was originally published in May 1994, and the creative team is Scott Lobdell, Richard Ashford, and Chris Cooper on writing, Ken Lashley and Robert Brown on pencil, Randy Elliott, Keith Champagne, Jason Gorder, and Don Hudson on inks, Chris Mathis on colors, Dave Sharp on letters, and Susan Gaffney and Bob Harris on editing. I didn't make a single mistake in that read. That was unbelievable.
Yeah.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do I?
A little help
if I can. All I need is my brother.
A little help if I can.
Welcome back to Bavaria, or wherever in Germany we are in this comic. I cannot honestly remember, but I do remember who I am, so I'll stick to what I know and introduce myself. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Anna Papard. I study and teach about and talk about gender and sexuality and other things in comics and pop culture, all around academia and on this fair internet, including at the Twitter account Sequential Scholars, where at the time of this episode dropping, I believe Andrew and I will be talking about Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Gatos' series Alias, aka the one that introduces Jessica Jones. I am also Kurt Wagner's official PR manager, and in that capacity, I do not have it in my heart to inform Mr. Wagner that his interpretation of Mystique's altruism might be wishful thinking, but you know, his heart's in the right place. I am joined, as always, by Mav. Please recall your secret origin.
Hello, my name is Christopher Maverick, a Bursaikon and Mitch Mavnenen. Ich spreche Agent Lit Kane Deutsch, also verwendet Google Translate, on these automatisch Zutun. Undying Kunstlich Intelligence Kopi Mainer Stim, for die ich die Wörter sprechen must mich. Easest wahrscheinlich wirklich schlimm. Unsir Zuhor die Deutsch sprechen denken wahrscheinlich. Das dies der Fall ist.
Translate it from the German.
Wow. Wow.
I don't know how good that is. That was either really weird or really interesting for anybody who actually speaks German and listens to our show.
I've heard Google Translate does a bad job with German because of the nature of like the comparison between English and German, but I don't know if that's true. That's just what I've heard.
Neither do I.
I think we do have some listeners who speak German, so yeah, do let us know. Do you want to do an English intro, or are you going to settle for that?
Well, first off, I always love that when it's like translated from the German rather than just German. I don't know why they do that. They also always have translate it from the Russian and translate it from the Spanish. And it's like, mm-hmm. I don't, like, are you introducing a translation error into English? But I wonder.
Yeah.
You know, but also, I was just very proud of the fact that I happen to have a bot that sounds like me as well as like.
It was pretty good.
Yeah. No. It is. It's literally AI trained to sound like me. I did that on purpose. So yeah. I have a math bot that I use for stuff like that. So I don't know if it's any good or not. But you know, that's how I feel about this comic too. I don't know if it's any good or not. But it's translated from the German.
I got first when you started doing it, I thought maybe you were just doing like a computer voice thing, because maybe you were doing a dig on like the zero strife thing, and then it took me a while to catch on. We're both very tired today.
No, no, the zero. So that's what gave me the idea of doing it.
I was like, okay,
there's an AI in this one, and half of it's in German, but not really German. So, yeah. Yeah, I can make that work. There were layers. I did have a thing going, yes.
I love it. Well, thank you for that, Mav. Andrew, please remind us of your family history.
Hi, I'm Dr. J. Andrew DeMann. I'm a lecturer at St. John's University and co-project lead for Sequential Scholars, a mostly Twitter-based endeavor. And what a great time to be based on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. So great. Great. Yep.
But to close
it's
the
going
loop.
Well.
Before Twitter implodes entirely, you should all go read the thing we've been talking about the last couple podcasts about how we peer pressured Mav into taking his DM thread on Terra in Teen Titans and just like, please give this to us so we can post it on Sequential Scholars. And he did, and everyone loved it, and it was a great dialogue.
It was fun. Aww. And I mean, and there was some pushback, which is fine, by the way.
Yeah, totally.
And but I mean, that's sort of the point of academic criticism, you know, including, I mean, Sequential Scholars, but also, you know, this show and literally everything that I've ever published ever. Every once in a while I get into an argument with a non-academic, it's like, well, you're wrong because of this. And I'm like, all right. I mean, sometimes I don't know that I'm wrong or right. This is how I feel about a thing, and sometimes people have interesting points that like contradict them, and that's neat. I'm not really precious about it. So, but I did have fun, and it is there are a lot of things that I had to say regarding that particular story that I've been, you know, maybe one day I'll write a full article about it. But right now it's like, yeah, I've got 11, 12, 18 tweets worth of stuff to say about this.
it was our longest thread on that account to date, and people did really enjoy it. And yeah, I mean, maybe this will end up being a eulogy by the time this episode drops, but yeah. it did emphasize the good bit of Twitter scholarship of getting people to really dialogue about a thing and share their ideas.
I remember Twitter.
I know, the good old days where we had academics talking with academics and fans and critics all together in a shared network of knowledge building and blah, 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 things we wrote in our grant application. But anyway, maybe things will turn out better than I'm thinking. Let's not.
Everything's fine. It's like the name of the dog. Everything is fine. There you go.
All right. Let's get to our fabulous returning guest who last joined us for a different Nightcrawler-centric issue in Excalibur 31. Oh, wow. I know he's a fan of the Fuzzy Elf, so this should be another fun convo. The pod is delighted to welcome back John Dorowski. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I don't have some witty banter there. Sorry.
I'm going to give you a glowing introduction, and then you can amuse us with your banter, John. So John Dorowski is a PhD candidate in comparative humanities at the University of Louisville. He is the editor of Adapting Superman, Essays on the Transmedia Man of Steel, and the co-editor of Critical Approaches to Horror Comic Books, Red Ink in the Gutter. Awesome title. So we did your comics origin story on our last pod, John. So we won't do that again here, but I thought I would just, you know, I know that you listen along with the pod. I know you've been reading along with the pod. So I thought I'd check in with you about how you're feeling about where we've been and where we've come and where we've arrived since Excalibur 31. I'll keep it open-ended for you. You can talk about the Day of Asira if you want. You can talk about what happened after that if you want. Yeah, what's sort of your feeling about what's been happening since you last joined us?
Well, I really enjoyed the Davis era. I realized that the first Excalibur comic book I bought was the beginning of Davis's run. I didn't understand that at the time because I was just barely getting into comics. But looking at that run, you know, that was a real kind of auteur run on a series where they were like single creators kind of left to do what they wanted. And now we've entered the editorial driven era where even though, you know, it's changed formats and it's supposed to still have this focus, it's been very muddled and directionless for the past 12 issues or so. You know, I haven't established a direction and a voice yet.
Yeah, we've definitely been feeling that. Well, can I ask you about We did X-Men Unlimited number 4 a couple of episodes ago, and I was curious about whether you kind of remember being curious about Nightcrawler's origins, or like, I know that you said when we did your origin story before that you were sort of introduced to Nightcrawler through trading cards and stuff, so that story might have already been revealed by the time that you sort of encountered the character, but like, yeah, I don't know, was like interest about who the character's parents were and what his backstory was that something that you were thinking about back then?
Not particularly. I believe there was a card that mentioned that Mystique was his mother, but mm-hmm. I had no context to put that in of, okay, so their mother's son, what does that mean? What's their actual relationship now? You know, it also hasn't been dealt with a lot since. It's just been part of the lore, but they don't treat each other like family at all, either even estranged family. Because also by the point when he finds out, he's a grown man. And he's already had his adopted family and his found family in the X-Men, and now Excalibur. So, like, does he need another family?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's like, it's like we talked about in that episode, you know, like in a little bit, and the next one too, that just, there's potential there. Like, I see rhetorical potential in it. It's just that, like, as you said, it hasn't really been maximized. But, you know, we do have some potentially interesting stuff with him and Margali in this issue, which I'll want to talk to you about as a contrast.
Yes, I found this much more interesting about the family dynamic than with Mystique.
Good. Well, let's talk about that. Let's do an issue summary and let's get into it. I want to get your first impressions of this particular comic. So I know we've got lots of lovely listeners reading along with the pod. We almost certainly love you more than Kurt's mom loves him. Aww. But before love can save the day, we need to set the scene, which we will do with an issue summary. That was so mean what I wrote. What was I thinking?
I was going to say which mom, and then I thought, well, actually either.
Both. Yeah. Okay. Excalibur
actually,
number 7.
I don't know that I mean that. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it. Margali is a complicated character, especially at this point in continuity when she hadn't done some of the really horrible things that she'll do later. So we'll talk about it. So Excalibur number 77 opens in the past with Kurt recalling his childhood. He's met by his human friend, Christian, who's been severely beaten. Apparently, it's a punishment from his parents for the crime of hanging out with Kurt, who's both a mutant and a member of a Romani family, and according to Christian's parents, a servant of the devil. Christian says they can't hang out anymore, and Kurt cries desperate tears, saying he'll try not to be a devil anymore. But then Kurt's adoptive mom, Margali Sardos, I say her name differently every time. But then Kurt's adoptive mother, Margali Sardos, arrives to save the day, assuring Kurt he's not a devil and that love lasts longer than hate. In the present, Nightcrawler teleports to safety with the young Romani boy he rescued from the angry mob in the last issue. Then the demon Despair finally reveals himself as a contributing cause of the chaos and shows Kurt that he has Margali as his captive, draining her magical powers to enhance his own. Kurt tries to attack Despair, but it's only a vision. Amanda shows up to teleport Kurt to where the real Despair is doing his thing. Meanwhile, in the woods of Maine, Zero runs from a cadre of Strife's robots who seem to be hunting him down under a directive from Strife to destroy all Strife-related data and materials, including Zero. Zero is shot but uses his powers to teleport away. Back in Germany, Kurt arrives at Despair's lair and watches as he begins to drain Margali's power. He attacks Despair with awesome swords, and while they're fighting, Amanda rescues Margali. Despair tries to tap into Kurt's traumatic past, zeroing in on Christian's rejection. But it turns out it turned out okay. Instead of reliving the trauma of rejection, Kurt relives reconnecting with Christian later in life, who apologizes for his past behavior and introduces Kurt to his son, Amel. Despair hates wholesomeness, which weakens him enough for Kurt to plunge a sword into his cold, cold heart. This makes the demon disappear and definitively frees Margali. Everybody is a sort of happy family once again. In the end, we check back in with Zero, holed up in a cave. As he assesses the damage to his body, a mysterious figure approaches. The being says it's part of the Phalanx Collective and looks a lot like Warlock with a little bit of Doug Ramsey. Wonder what's going on there? We'll talk about that in the future. Okay, so John, I think you said you had spots, but we will have to be talking about Doug Lock lots in the future, yes.
Okay, I guess.
It'll come up. Okay. I'm looking forward to talking about it at least, okay.
Well, it's just the way you said it. It's like, you know, it looks a little bit like Warlock with Doug Ramsey. I'm like, well, it's Warlock with Doug Ramsey.
Pretty much. It's not really really a secret so much as like, what is that gonna mean? And anyway, whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, we're like coming to this big reveal, and it's weird. It's like, oh, look at this. What could this be? And then the next issue, they'll tell you, and it's like, oh, okay.
Well, he'll be with us for the duration of the series, so we'll have lots more opportunities to talk about him. But yeah, John, I was trying to come to you with your first impressions, so let's do that. How are you feeling about this one, John? Anything that you're particularly eager to talk about?
Well, there are a few things. First, I want to mention that the Bullpen Bulletins is a tribute to Jack Kirby after his passing.
I didn't even notice that.
I want to talk about that too.
Okay.
So we will come back to that. As for the issue itself, I think when you have three writers, two pencilers, and four inkers, it screams fill-in issue, that they had a schedule at the printer and they needed to get something in. Mm-hmm. And for that, this is an all right issue. Like, if you consider those conditions of probably rushing to get this in there, it turns out all right. You have a potentially interesting conflict of a good-looking demon fighting an evil-looking demon. the themes of love and hope versus despair that are unfortunately undercut by the structure of the story, where a lot of the important action happens off-panel, and just how they pace the story was odd. And I also think that there was potential to tie in Zero thematically with the story. And on the cover, it states that this issue has the most shocking guest star of all, which I assume is Zero. But if you haven't been reading the other X-Men titles, it would be less surprising and more confusing, as in, who is this and why should I care?
I was, to be honest, wondering who they meant by the most surprising guest star. I was like, did they mean Kurt's boyfriend Christian, or who were we talking
his
about?
Son.
I know.
Or is this the mysterious figure on the last panel?
I
know.
It's supposed to be. That's why I was talking about before. I think it's supposed to be a big shock. It's like, oh my god, who could this be? That looks like Doug Ramsey and Warlock. It's Doug Ramsey and Warlock.
Except not if they're just showing up on the last panel, are they a guest star?
Yeah. More of a cameo. I'm not clear. That's what I assume it was, and I'm like, eh.
Well, I want to come back to the Kirby thing for sure, and I'll pick up some first impressions from Andrew and Mav. Maybe that will be one of yours. But like, yeah, Mav, I think you were feeling okay about this one, and I mostly agree with
John.
I think it's a surprisingly effective issue. Yeah.
Yeah, I like this issue. I actually think it's good. I'm making fun of that last panel because it does feel like, hey, we haven't had a cliffhanger here, kids. Here's a cliffhanger. But up until that point, I actually think this is really strong character work for Kurt, and I like how it's written. I mean, is it necessarily, we've talked about this before, I don't feel the need to make sure everybody fits exactly into continuity, because I want the writers to have their own breathing room. This is they should have, if they're going to script this, they should have the breathing room to do the Ashford and Lobdell version of Kurt rather than the Davis and Claremont version of Kurt. So I'm fine with that, and I like this. The character, he doesn't seem out of character. He seems like a believable version of the Kurt Wagner that I've read up until that point. I feel like I recognize the Margley character, kind of. Despair, whatever. But I also, I think I've said on this before, on the show before, my favorite thing about superhero comics is always all the non-superhero events. Like, I want people to have superpowers, and then I want them to use them in interesting ways to play baseball. Or I like when, you know, I love when you...
Just like what? Twilight.
Yeah, sure. But I love when you solve a conflict with a demon using the power of friendship. That's kind of great to me. I mean, I'm all about it. Like he doesn't teleport, he doesn't punch. I mean, yes, I get that he also stabs him with the sword. Fine. But the innovative part is, yes, he used, you know, emotions and morals and feelings, and there was more to it than just, I can punch you harder than you can punch me. I never care about, you know, can the Hulk beat Superman in a fight? I've never cared about that. I love when you've got, you know, an interesting like drama of like character and emotion and clever bits. That's what I like about narrative in general, or at least that's just what I personally like about narrative in general. I thought this was well done, and I enjoyed reading it.
Aw, yeah. How are you feeling about it, Andrew?
I'm much colder on this one than I think the rest of you are, and that's cool. To me, I think there's not enough payoff from the previous issue. I don't think it flows well, and I think it ends with the kind of pace of like a Dungeons and Dragons campaign when someone's mom has announced that they're coming to pick them up, and it's just quickly end it fast. I found that kind of, I mean, exactly as John was talking about, I found it to be very much, this is a fill-in. This is not a properly structured story. story in my eyes. So yeah, no, I'm definitely colder on it, but I hear what you guys are saying about some of the character work.
Well, let's get into that a little bit more. And I wanted to talk about the flashback that opens the comic specifically. And I thought we could academicize it a little bit by talking about kind of the nature of flashbacks and why these often exist in stories and what kind of rhetorical devices they serve. And John, a veteran of the Protagonist podcast and a scholar of such things, I'm sure you have thoughts about it. So I'll put it to you, John. What is kind of the rhetorical function of using a flashback in this kind of story? Why open with this?
Well, that was actually one of the structural problems I had, was opening with a flashback.
Okay.
When we ended on a cliffhanger last time of Kurt unconscious in the street, and we open with a flashback here, and that's disorienting to the reader rather than grounding them in the story. And then when we do get to Kurt, he's awake and has teleported the boy to a roof with no sense of what happened in between. I think structurally, this would have been, and I'm going to play armchair editor here, would have been better if this flashback happened after Kurt encounters Despair, and Despair actually inflicted this on him, so that Kurt would then have to overcome his internal despair before confronting the physical embodiment of despair. And that, and as I said, you could have thematically woven that in with Zero in some ways, because they're both teleporters. In that situation, both would have been overcoming internal problems. Zero, his programming. Kurt, his own personal despair. So you would have at least had something bringing those two stories together. I'm not saying very well, but it would have been something.
Ooh, yeah. I like
parallelism,
that.
Parallelism of them both being teleporting did not occur to me till just now. I didn't even notice. So yeah, yours was better. Because it's like, they are both teleporters. Didn't even notice that they had the same power set when reading it.
And then when Kurt confronts Despair later, Despair would have been able to try and inflict harm again, emotional harm again, and Kurt would have been prepared for it and said, no, I have this good memory ready now to counter you.
Yeah, because like I sort of was willing to buy it as like, okay, well, he's thinking about this because of the like racial riot that he encountered in the last issue, and then maybe he's knocked unconscious and then, you know, has the thing where you dream a very specific memory, which is totally how dreams work, but it's how dreams often work in genre stories. Yeah. So like, I'll go with it, but it doesn't work, you're right, with the pacing in terms of, I mean, all the stuff that you just said, right? Like the conflict with Despair doesn't really make sense, and then like how we come out of the flashback doesn't really make sense. But I could also see why they put it at the beginning, because they were trying to go for that disorienting effect. You're just like, oh, what's happening here, little Nightcrawler? And then that's like the hook, even though it doesn't pace right. So you almost wonder if it was like shifted around or something.
And I will say that I think the disorienting effect is effective when they do the two-page spread where it's, you have to flip the comic book on its side unnecessarily. There's nothing in there that needs that format except to disorient you.
Yeah, they love doing that flip on your side thing during this era. Can be interesting depending, but yeah, I'm just still interested in like what we're kind of achieving with this flashback for Kurt. Like, I mean, does it help us understand him more as a character? I mean, that's often what we're doing with flashbacks, right? We're often using them to explain why a character is reacting to certain things in the present, because they had this experience in the past, and this like reveals that to the reader or viewer or whatever, depending on what kind of text we're talking about. So like, I mean, I'll ask that of you, Andrew, you know, obviously someone who's studied the character of Nightcrawler, written on the character of Nightcrawler, like, does this reveal of this aspect of his backstory, which again, this is the first time other than X-Men Annual number 4 that we'd had like an extensive flashback, and this is the first time we've seen Kurt as a kid, so in theory it's filling in a piece of his backstory that we hadn't had before. Like, do you find it productive?
Not very productive. I think it's maybe a little cliche in what it sets up.
Well, yeah,
I do find it productive to showcase Kurt's sense of alienation, as you said, from his perspective as a child, particularly this precocious, upside down, chasing butterflies kind of child. That to me is very interesting. The idea of this is an interior aspect of Kurt, almost like his inner child in some ways. I think it creates room to therefore make his backstory and his relationship to isolation and community a little bit more complicated, but mostly just through that visual juxtaposition, because as I said, the story feels a little bit too rote for me. And I hate the thing where he shows back up and is like, I was your best friend when we were 6 and now we're best friends again.
Here's
my kid. Nobody remembers their friend from when they were 6 unless they stayed with that friend for a very long time thereafter. So it feels to me very Hallmark Channel in a way that I think is, you know, not right for a character like Kurt, who has the level of complexity in terms of his relationship to his own sense of monstrosity that we've talked about before. So it feels a little bit like a letdown, but there's room to expand things a little bit. And I think just the idea of representing Kurt's childhood experience is pretty genius, especially what a good visual storyteller can do with it.
I'm a little bit hotter on it than you are, but I'll let Mav say his piece on it first. What did you think about this flashback, Mav?
Andrew is 100% right, and I don't care. I like it. I like it because you are right in that this is heartstringy, and it is melodrama, and it is saccharinely sweet, and that's what it is. I mean, it's manipulative, and it's very basic. You're right. You're right in that, like, oh, well, let's look at him as a kid, and he can be cute, and, I mean, he's chasing butterflies. I mean, come on, right?
So, like, I have to say. Yeah,
I get that it's being manipulative, and I get that it is entirely artificial, and it's like, hey, we were friends back then, and now we are going to be again, because friendship. And that's stupid and not how the world works. But I like it for this story. Like, I don't know that this would have worked if it were a long form. Like, if they tried to do this as a 6-issue arc and this was like the pathos of Kurt trying to come to grips with Christian. No. But Christian exists for exactly 4 pages of comics in the history of Marvel. And that's fine. You know, like, for just this moment to have this hallmarky moment to show me that Kurt has a sense of anxiety, I'll say. I won't call it depression. He has a sense of anxiety as a child over how he looks and his difference and his otherness, but he was also just a regular kid who tried his best to just sort of live his life in the world that a 6-year-old can live life in. And it's like, hey, we're gonna go do this, come on, Lone Ranger, come on, Tony. Like I get that, and that feels authentic to me, in as much as, you know, a story in the funny pages can be authentic. So, like, I didn't mind the melodrama of it. I didn't mind the suspension of disbelief that I have to have in order to make this moment work. Because you're right, you know, in real life, no, I don't want to talk to you. You abandoned me 25 years ago. You know, why am I interested in this? Or probably, you know, 20 years ago, whatever, you know, however long it is between when Kurt sees him in the circus and when he's, you know, when he's 6. So I'm just okay with it, I guess.
I want to bring up one thing that you mentioned there, Mav, and that they play Lone Ranger and Tonto, but Kurt, I don't know whether by choice or how they decided, is playing Tonto.
Yes, because he's the other. I mean, I understand why it's problematic, but I also understand that, like, having had white friends that I played with when I was a little kid, you've got to be, if you're the black guy, you've got to be the othered character, because that's what happens. History's not great about making pop culture heroes that are, you know, minorities that have the white sidekick, right? There are some, but there's not a lot. And certainly not at the point when he would have been growing up. So that, you know, like, when I'm playing Star Wars when I'm 7, I'm Lando. I'm not Han Solo. And so I get it. I understand why it's problematic as well, but I get it.
I think it's believable too, in context of, like, these are German kids that are playing American stories, and so, like, they wouldn't have a context for that being problematic necessarily. So, like,
they're also 6.
Too. Yeah,
I mean, they're 6 years old.
I mean, they're not. Yeah. It's not on them. Yeah. But yeah, did you have more thoughts about that, John? Like, did you find that an interesting choice?
As Mav says, you know, it's partly a generic choice of pop culture's hero and sidekicks that they might have played in Germany whenever this is supposed to take place in the past. But that specific choice also plays into, you know, issues of colonialism, of westward expansion, and this othering, and that they make Kurt the other, both in, even when they play, is, you know, perhaps on a bit on the nose, but is relevant nonetheless.
Well, it speaks to one of the things that I did sort of like about this scene. And again, I like this in terms of it being a bit of a low bar, just because stories never talk about it. But, like, the way it's specifically emphasized here that Christian can't play with Kurt, both because he's a mutant who looks like a devil and because he's Romani. Both things are presented as part of his otherness here that are, like, intersecting to make him ultra othered. And, you know, mutant metaphor is complicated. We talked about this many times on the podcast, but emphasizing that specific intersectionality here did make me a little bit excited, just because, you know, it opens the door for us to talk about that as an intersection of this character's identity. And I think, again, a part of the reason that interests me so much is that it's been completely dropped as an aspect of the character at this point in time. But like, it opens the door for us to read this character as sort of racialized in a more interesting way, and sort of bringing these cultural histories together, bringing these metaphors together with real world contexts. And I was like excited by that element of it, which, you know, feeds into the conversations that we're having about the Tonto thing. But the other thing I liked too was like that emphasis on his cuteness, because I do think that that's interesting in the context of people responding to Kurt as a monster, and the sort of heavy emphasis on his chibi cuteness here, that like, he didn't look like a monster as a kid. He looked adorable, and yet despite the fact that he clearly looks adorable and is adorable in every single way, he's still treated as a monster. And I also like the little bit of how he doesn't perceive himself that way, and how that's emphasized too, like he has no knowledge of hate, because I don't know, that speaks to kind of the self-acceptance of the character and what kind of makes him a bit of an interesting character that way, because he didn't necessarily grow up with people trying to beat him up all the time. He did grow up in this like circus that was like this found family of quote-unquote freaks, in which he did feel more accepted than he might have felt in a more traditional environment, and that speaks to his capacity for self-acceptance and self-reflection. And then I liked, as related to that, you know, like him kind of doing the start of a Catholic shame thing where he's like, oh, I'll promise God that I won't be a devil anymore. And then Margali steps in and was like, you are not, you know, love is stronger than hate. And then if we're going to assume that he like learns Catholicism from her, that opens. Well, I mean, we've talked about this before, but like, there's no point in continuity where he could have picked up Catholicism. Yes, it just doesn't, like, when? Like, when he moved into the mansion?
No.
From who? Well,
it's his continuity is broken. We talked about this before. Does Margali find him when he's a toddler or when he's a baby? It depends on which story it is. If Margali found him when he's a baby, then why the hell is his last name Wagner and not Zardos? If she adopted him, wouldn't she call him Kurt Zardos? Like, none of it makes sense. I'm fine with that, but I don't, because of everything else about her, I do not presume that she is a practicing Catholic. I presume he picked it up from, I don't know, maybe somebody else in the circus, or maybe after he's a teenager, he just decides, you know what, I'm gonna get into the church. That's fine. It doesn't scan for me that he picked it up from her at all, because I read him as going, oh no, I am doing this Christian guilt thing. This very Catholic, I promise God, save me and I will never be this. And she is rejecting that. She is saying no, you know, a much more pagan mentality of no, this is not about, you know, how God made you or didn't. It's not, you're not being punished. This is you. You are accepted and you are loved. I am your mother and I love you. That's what she's saying. And I think that the distinction of her not having that kind of religious baggage that he has, wherever he got it from. I mean, and this does, because he is talking to God, so this does imply that he has some sort of religious center. I think the fact that she doesn't share it exactly, but that she still loves him as her son, is important.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would point out she does send him to Dante's Inferno in X-Men Annual number 4, which, you know, does imply she's well versed in Catholicism.
Yes. Well, no, but it doesn't imply that she believes or she follows it. That's the weirdness, right? Like, I don't think she's a devout Catholic. She might be aware of the mythos, but I don't think she's I am going to take the sacrament. That doesn't scan with anything about her to me.
Well, I think the problem is Nightcrawler shouldn't be either, but people have misunderstood that about the character. But I mean, but that's sort of my point too. Like, I'm not disagreeing with any of that, but like, that's sort of, again, what I find interesting about this, because it speaks to what I would want from that character's relationship with religion to be, that he would have sort of a complex, sort of reflective approach to his religion, where he is able to step outside of it and be like, some of this stuff it says is not right because this kid said this thing to me and my mom, who is a pagan witch, told me that that's not true. So like, it's a way for him to like negotiate a position sort of within those belief systems. And I find that little moment effective in that way, just seeing that he got some of those values from her, I think is important. And like, again, not followed up on, because we have all of these questions about where his other belief system possibly comes from, which has never been explained in a canonical story, which is a huge problem. But anyway,
well, it's the same. But again, it's the same as his name. His name doesn't make sense with anything that we know about him. His last name is not Darkholm. It's not Zvardos. Why is he Wagner?
Happen? They explain it in a non-canonical origin story that also explains his Catholicism. And it's one of my most hated Nightcrawler comics of all time. It's bad.
But I mean, you're getting, like, that's why I said I think this is as a moment in a story, as one story, as this one comic, I like this. But John opened up this episode pointing out that it does not follow from the last issue. Why is it just, like, from a storytelling point of view, if I'm looking at this as a two issue story, it's very broken. But if I jump in from just this point, I don't think I need last issue. And I can enjoy this story by itself. But I get that I'm cheating. I get that I'm sort of dismissing the entire concept of our show doing one issue at a time in order to enjoy this one book.
Well, I mean, my fix for it would have been, like, we should have had the flashbacks woven across both issues to make that a thematic component of both rather than just introduced here.
Yeah, that would have been, I mean, and that would have made the story work better. And in a 2022 context, when things are written in order to be in six issue, you know, trade paperbacks, that's what it would have been, right? Like, they would have never done it as a one issue trope. It just that would never happen today.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the relationship with Kurt and Margalia, because I think, John, you said you had some thoughts about it as well. Like, did you find this relationship between these two characters in this comic compelling? And if it was compelling, why was it compelling?
I don't find it compelling, but like I said, for Amelia, this was like an introduction to Margalia. So they have to establish certain things. So we've talked a lot about with the flashback scene Christian, but I think equally important is the page where Margalia shows up afterwards and comforts Kurt, because that shows her acting as a mother and establishes the relationship between them and why Kurt would fight for her through this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, establishing that motherly bond is so different than, you know, the issues that we've talked about with his relationship with Mystique, where there just kind of is no bond, right?
Yeah, and there's a parallel there too with X-Men Unlimited number 4, with the scene where Mystique shows that same sort of compassion to Rogue.
That's true.
It also sets up the ending of the story where Margalia asks Kurt for forgiveness for what? I'm not sure, because I don't know all the background. There's not enough context given there. But he says, like, look, we have a complex relationship, but of course I'm going to forgive you and love you still at this point.
Yes, this was before, I believe in a later issue of Excalibur, she's going to kill an estimated 300,000 people, which is a problem and kind of broke that character forever, unfortunately, because that's too many people to forgive her.
That is a genocide, yes.
That's a legit genocide. And then, like, Kurt forgiving her after that raises questions, although, you know, it depends whether we count certain stories or not, because continuity gets even more confusing after a point. But, like, so here, like, I mean, he's forgiving her for, like, basically what happened in, like, that X-Men annual forever ago, which, you know, we could have an editor's note about that. That would be helpful. But
they do refer to the annual, but not enough to know what was happening there.
That was a messed up annual also, so it wouldn't really be covered in an editor's note.
I think it's enough to know that she is nebulously a supervillain. I mean, and yes, I realize it's more complicated than that, but I think that if you're in John's place and you don't know much about her, I think you can read this story and go, okay, she is a bad person, but they legitimately love each other. And I think that that's what this scene's for. Like, you can tell.
Yeah, they give enough for me to understand for this one issue.
Right. And you look at it and you say, okay, he was down, and I mean, you know that he's adopted, and she calls him, you know, like, my little angel, and everything. Like literally, it's like, this is a mommy coming to a son and saying, oh, you're sad because of your fight with your friend. I understand what that's like, but, you know, I still love you. And that is nice. It's a moment. Because after that, every appearance that we've seen of her since her first appearance, and from here on out, she's going to do deplorable things. She is a bad person reaching for power on her own. She's manipulative towards all of her children. And she is objectively bad in many, many ways. But this helps me go, but I understand why he can't let it go, why he loves her. Because at the end of the day, that's still his mom to him. You know, I mean, it's an effective mom.
Yeah. What do you think, Andrew? Did you find anything of value in kind of the relationship here, or like other thoughts about what might make this relationship compelling?
So no, not really. It feels very like too distant from when she was established. I think we talked about this a little bit with Amanda as well. Claremont had big plans for Margali. There was a proposed superhero arcane team with Margali and Amanda at the head of it, doing kind of Doctor Strangey things throughout the Marvel canon. So it's this character who was designed to be central, not sidelined. But as a result of sort of publishing stuff happening, she got sidelined. And as a result of that, you get that weird sort of element where she's not necessarily an effective foil, or at least wasn't designed to be, but at the same time isn't in that starring role. So there's all these like depths and continuity issues and questions of motivation and all these things that make her a little bit burdensome to the narrative in my eyes, without proper cultivation and treatment.
Yeah, there's so much that I tend to read into the character that's like not on the page just because I want her to be more compelling than she is. Because even this idea of the winding way that she follows and what exactly that is. And I mean, you know, I can extrapolate from real similar mysticism some of what that might mean and some of what Claremont might have been drawing from to inform that if he'd had a chance to develop it. But like the problem is it's just so inconsistent in comics. Like, I mean, it would make sense if it's sort of like a journey of self-discovery that like tempts you with power and sort of that's part of it, and so she's not really evil, it's just sort of the way you negotiate good and bad magic, and that's present in some of the stories with Margali, but then also in some of the stories she's just objectively cartoonishly villainously evil, and that really destroys that possible complexity that I think we do have here, even though it's not really developed.
We don't even know that she's pagan. I said that because I have no better analog, because she doesn't, those stories don't exist, right? What is the Winding Way? The Winding Way is a vague, unexplained religion, mysticism, plot device, right? Like it doesn't, and it's been, I mean, it's now been 40 years, right? And forever, right? It's been a long time, and this has not been resolved other than, she disappears from continuity for years on a stretch all the time. And then, she'll show up and it's like, if I need to explain something, I just say, yeah, so she was following the Winding Way. And eventually that sort of happens with Amanda too, right? It's just like magic stuff. Yeah, now let's move on. And that's like as far as you get with it, which is frustrating. I get that. And that's why I think maybe why I like this is I like that, someone's at least trying to do something interesting. This is more than a lot of other stories where it's just like, hey, she's back and she's green now. Now let's move on.
And I think the previous time she would have showed up, like previous to this issue, would have been in an issue of Doctor Strange where she was really just cartoonishly evil. Like she has Amanda show up and just like kind of as her puppet and like attack Doctor Strange and get totally jobbed. And like I think that had been the last time we saw her before this. So an improvement on that, I would say.
And that was probably years before.
In
publishing, yeah.
All right. I really want to talk about the Kurt and Christian scene, but we can talk a little bit about Despair too, if you want. We talked about Despair a little bit the last time. We had Despair, but if John has thoughts about it, you're welcome to contribute them. You did say that you found it interesting having like the good demon versus the bad demon in the Despair showdown, John. So yeah, was there anything else you wanted to say about it? Did you find Despair an effective foil here?
No, I think he was plugged in as they wanted something for the story and just plugged in a villain that had a power set they wanted, and it could have been anybody. But by choosing Despair, you end up with a little more resonance than like a hate monger showing up.
Do you?
I did not say a lot more resonance. I just said a little bit.
Well, at least Despair has kind of the, the brings out your traumas and stuff thing. So you get people like reliving memories, which again is a little bit more than hate monger.
I actually not sure about that. I did not understand his power set.
No, no one does.
Because they're very vague. Previous issue, it was something of, it wasn't that he was feeding off their despair, but fear was feeding off of him. It was very confusing. And so, they needed a villain to plug in. They had a story in mind. And I don't know if they specifically had despair in mind, but it was, we need a villain. Who can we use? This will work. And, like I said, it's a little more resonant. It's a little more effective because it is like dichotomy of good looking demon versus bad looking demon. But without the element of Kurt overcoming internal despair. It's just a generic villain.
I'm gonna like I headcanon it a little bit as like, because there is this thing with Nightcrawler that I really like, that I find very amusing, where like, and this isn't in every story, but it comes up several times, that demons will try to like tempt him with bad stuff and he's just so resistant to that. I mean, we even saw that in the Inferno issues, right? Like, he resists like the demonic manipulation, and in that episode we talked about, well, Kurt's already used to sort of reckoning with his monstrousness, so he'd be more resistant to it than a character like Megan, for whom that possession feeds into her powers as well. But like, I do sort of like that thing that despair tries to whammy him, and it's just like, no, Kurt's heart only has love in it, therefore this is completely ineffective against him. And again, I'm bringing that to the story, but yeah. That's how I'm choosing to read it.
Yeah, well, with that dichotomy, Kurt has to represent the opposite of despair. Mm-hmm. And so in this, he has love, he has hope, and that does play into his characterization effectively.
Well, because I mean, the thing of Kurt, of like him looking like a demon and being the opposite of that, I mean, it does work for me here a little bit, because people keep trying to introduce like him having like a reckoning with like the demonic part of him. I mean, that's what the problem with the Draco is. That's why people don't like that story. But like, mm-hmm. I think what actually makes the character interesting is the fact that that isn't his conflict, because you expect that's going to be his conflict. Oh, he has a monster inside of him that he's reckoning with, and he has to get past that view of himself as a monster. It's like, nah, that's actually not really his conflict. Yeah, I know. That's like not his conflict. So when he's faced with a demon like this, that is like, oh, I bet that's your conflict. He's like, no, it's not actually. I was friends with that guy. It's cool. And like, again, I'm bringing a lot to that to make it work. But like, I do like that he's not manipulatable in that way, because that's just, that isn't the nature of his internal conflict. I mean, he has doubts, he has shame that comes up, but he's also had time to negotiate those feelings. And even through the flashback here with Margaly, like telling him the thing about love being greater than hate, we see where he gets some of the fodder to be able to, you know, have that confidence and to be able to sort of manage those fears. And like, again, I'm doing so much to make this work. I completely acknowledge that I'm rewriting the story in my head, and I'm surprised by how much I'm fighting for it, but I'm doing my best.
I knew we were going to talk about despair, and I took the liberty of ahead of time pulling the issue of the Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe Deluxe Edition, which I have mentioned on the show before, that deals with despair. I think it's important to understand that despair isn't so much a villain or a character so much as he's a cool spelling and a neat look for a costume. That's where it is. So I want to I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm just going to give some highlights from the Official Handbook. Now, I want you to understand that in the Official Handbook, this was written primarily by Mark Gruenwald and Peter Sanderson, who were the original like pedantic comic geeks. They were married to continuity. They went and they pored over stuff to get details and make this complete encyclopedia of the Marvel Universe. So, despair, real name unknown, occupation inapplicable, legal status none, identity despair's existence is unknown to the general public of Earth. Former aliases, despair often masquerades as people trusted by his victims. Okay, that's at least something. Place of origin, unknown. Marital status, probably inapplicable. known relatives, none. Group affiliation, none. Base of operations, unknown, but not within Earth's dimension. First appearance of Marvel Team at 68. History, the origin of the demonic being known as despair is unknown. And it goes on and on and on. Now I'm going to skip most of the origin, which is mostly a lot of we don't know stuff. Oh, and then there was this story in Marvel Team Up, and then there's a story with Spider-Man. Like, it's literally like a lot of, you know, very, very vague. I want to skip forward to his known powers, because he's a cipher. Known superhuman powers. Despair is a demon who apparently draws psychic sustenance from the fear, anguish, and despondency suffered by human beings, and perhaps other sentient beings as well.
Perhaps.
In feeling such strong emotions, people generate psychic energies. Apparently, despair feeds upon such energies, adding them to his own reserves of psychic force. It may be that despair does not need the psychic energies generated by humans, but torments them psychologically merely for the sadistic pleasure of it. Despair can mystically instill fear in human beings. Usually, however, despair seems to prefer to act indirectly and cause his victim to generate his own fear by mystically filling the victim's mind with illusions. These illusions will be of situations that cause the victim to feel terror, great sadness, and despondency, and possibly even suicide urges. Presumably, Despair has telepathic abilities that enable him to perceive in his victim's mind what would produce such effects in him, and then to project the illusions into his mind. Despair has various other mystical abilities which have yet to be cataloged. He has a physical form and can be harmed. It is unknown whether he can be killed. Literally, these are the two people charged with detailing the Marvel Universe. They wrote a one-page encyclopedia entry for him, like essentially doing Wikipedia all by themselves. And if you read the handbook, which I did as a kid, I read it cover to cover many, many times. This is the one entry where they're like, yeah, you know, he does some stuff. He's from somewhere, we guess, maybe.
It's so funny because they're so into rules and like encyclopedias and completedness, and it's like written in this backhanded way, like they're mad at other people for not figuring this character. like apparently he can do this. I mean, apparently he has these kinds of powers, presumably, and you're like, it would have been nice if you guys figured this out so we didn't have to presuppose all these things. It's like they're so pissed.
It is the most generic entry in the handbook. It's so much like, yeah, we think this is how it works. Yeah. So it's hard to say he's the opposite of Nightcrawler because he's literally just sort of he's a costume that you can throw for Kurt to stab later. It's okay for Kurt to stab him because he's a demon, we think. I mean, maybe. Like, it doesn't, like, we don't even know, right? Like, you know, like, here's the thing. What if Despair's just a dude, right? Like, we treat him like he's a demon, but what if he's just some dude in a costume? Kurt just stabbed this dude in the chest. You know, that would suck. So let's just assume he's a demon.
Kurt murder him? Or what are the rules? How does Kurt know which people he can murder and which people he can't murder?
I don't know. Presumably, it's fine.
He decides by intuition who he can stab or not.
So all I wanted to say was that Despair is now a recurring Excalibur villain. We've got 77 issues, and a lot of our iconic Excalibur villains are not recurring. You know, they sort of only get one arc. I'm thinking like Necrom, Arcade, the Warwolves.
Juggernaut.
Despair gets two. He gets two.
Oh my God, does that make him their arch nemesis? Just how bad things are for Excalibur in the villain department. My goodness.
Since this issue did not involve most of Excalibur, I don't know if that counts.
That's true. Okay, before we run out of time, I want to say my piece about like the Christian and Kurt page, which is like my favorite part of this comic. But like, okay, so one contextual thing that maybe doesn't matter, but I did just want to footnote it, is that like we have three writers on this issue, one of whom is Chris Cooper. So Chris Cooper was one of the possibly the only like out gay writer and slash editor at Marvel during this time. He worked on the Marvel swimsuit specials, and you know, I don't know how much he was responsible for like the queer coding of some of those specials, but it is at least interesting how much they include and the fact that he worked on them. People also will know him from the bird watching while black scandal more recently, but in terms of that being relevant to this page, like this page just reads as incredibly queer to me in a variety of ways. Like, you know, Andrew joked earlier that, you know, it really seems like Christian is bringing his and Kurt's kid that Kurt didn't know about to like meet him for the first time, which is, again, like if you switch the genders here, it would really, really read like that, right? And you know, if you're open-minded enough to believe that could be the case, then it could read that way as well. But like, so there's a few different reasons that like make me read it that way, and it's not just the fact that this page has bisexual lighting. But like, it totally does.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's the use of loving code names, you know, that is from their childhood, and like that's very like queer in a variety of ways. It doesn't have to be, but it does strongly signal that. And like there's this long pause before Christian clarifies and emphasizes the nature of his relationship with Kurt. Like, this is my dot 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 best friend, and then best friend is like ultra bolded as though it's trying to draw attention to the loadedness of that phrase, both with the pause and through the bolding. And then there's the way it's drawn. There's how clearly Christian's face appears in Kurt's memory, like it is the literally central part of this memory, and he's rendered in like total like romance character handsomeness, square-jawed handsomeness. So yeah, like there's a lot of different elements of that page that I'm like, I totally don't think that that was the intention. A lot of these things are on the artist, so I don't want to be like, this is some like, you know, deeply coded thing that was on purpose. But at the same time, I do find it interesting how present that reading is there. And it was something that like, yeah, just interested me, I guess. I'm not like trying to argue for intention one way or the other, but like, but yeah, definitely one of those scenes.
It doesn't matter whether it's intentional.
Exactly. But still, when I saw that Chris Cooper was one of the co-writers on this, that did like be like, that's interesting. But like, yeah, I don't know. Was I the only one, presumably, that read it that way? Or did some of those elements come across to any of you?
Not as much as you did. I mean,
yeah, I can see it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I would not, I did not pick up on the idea that this might be their son together at all. I see what you say, but that's not what's there for me. It is definitely a, God, this is a whole different conversation. But there is much bisexual literature of this era, in comics and outside, but in of this era of pop culture, plays on the idea of homosociality rather than homosexualism because of what can be done in American fiction during the era. Like, so you have a lot of what we would argue in 2022 might be queer-coded things that show up in just sort of brotherly bonding type media that goes from the 80s and to an extent in heavily masculine macho, you know, movies today. Like there's I'm thinking Fast and Furious, right? The Fast and Furious franchise is nothing but queer subtext through all of the Brian and Dom relationship. Like it's real clear, and it's certainly not intentional because Vin Diesel didn't write that, you know. Like that's not a, you know, that's not what it's trying to do, but it's still there because that's just how culturally we represent masculinity in brotherhood right now. So I think it's a valid reading, and more interesting if you consider, well, you know, maybe, you know, did they have a relationship, did they not? Well, the ambiguity is what makes it interesting, more so than I actually like that better than if there's like, and here's Kurt's lover returned. I actually like the ambiguity better, so I'm there for it.
And there's like the whole context of the relationship too, like they were so close and then they were not allowed to hang out with each other anymore because of like Kurt's like difference, and then they reunite in this touching moment with like the establishment of like an accepting found family. There's just a lot of elements of it that can go in that direction. I just wanted to point it out. Okay, let's do some final thoughts. Give everybody a chance to talk about something that we can get a chance to talk about. I'll come to you first, Andrew. Anything in this comic that you wanted to signpost that we didn't get a chance?
And John can speak to this as well. The problem that I had with the commemoration of Kirby's life that Stanley presents, he presents it as this intense honoring of Kirby, but the entire thing presents Kirby as merely an illustrator of other people's ideas, and I found it just so infuriating that Lee's doing that on the occasion of Kirby's death. You know what I mean? It just felt like such gross capitalism, and all the reasons that a lot of comic scholars have animosity towards Stan Lee really got exacerbated in that for me, because on the one hand, he's presenting it as celebrating this comics great who helped him with Marvel Comics, but on the other hand, he's very much presenting it as if Kirby's just the guy who drew the pictures, and that is such a miscredit to a really important talent in comics.
How else would he do it, though? Because the problem is, that's how Stan saw him, because Stan's gone now, too. Well,
but not to this extreme. There's no way he perceived it to this extreme. As if Kirby was just the guy. No, God, no.
Okay.
He has to know Kirby's creating the stories. He's penciling in the dialogue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. No.
He knows who came up with Surfer and Galactus.
I know, but I find it believable that Stan is enough of an egoist he wouldn't believe
that. Yeah, I agree with you that that's what happened. I'm trying to not badmouth Stan as much as like academics can, because I've met Stan. Stan was actually quite lovely to me. I believe that Stan believed that he did all the writing and Jack did all the pictures. And why did Jack have this falling out? Because why doesn't he understand that the reason that our relationship worked is because he was so good at illustrating, making manifest all this stuff that I created. I believe that Stan believed that.
I can't. Okay. Just from what we know of the historical accounts of how the process worked.
Ditko's
dropping off pages entirely for you with no consultation, and you're just filling in the text. Kirby's doing the same towards the end of their relationship.
I don't think Stan thinks you wrote that. I think he thinks he did.
Oh,
I thought he did.
That might be a crueler indictment, though.
I think it is. I'm saying this as someone who personally liked Stan. I think Stan believed that he wrote those things, and it's problematic, and I understand why in some ways that's even worse, but I don't think it's malicious. I think Stan believes that, you know, we were so in sync that they were drawing the stuff that I just thought up in my head, and then I don't think he thinks that he's just doing words. I think he thinks he's plotting. There are many stories to the effect of Stan just kind of forgetting things and doing why does Iron Man have a nose? Why doesn't he have a nose? It's just the whims of Stan. So he does that, and he thinks he's making decisions. And there's a lot of just that. The Marvel method led to a lot of Stan's egotism developing. This is a longer conversation. I think Stan wrote this thinking, this is a loving tribute to my friend, and I wish we hadn't fallen out, because I don't understand. Yeah, like, I don't think it's so gross.
I think he's marking out his territory.
I think we're sort of in agreement.
It's just like a matter of like motivation, because I agree. It's just that like I think that at that point he'd like self-mythologize so much that I could see him just doing that and believing it. Because like, I mean, think about that Marvel method thing. Like, he's getting the pages from Kirby, and like to his mind, he's like, oh, Jack drew all these great things and I really appreciate it, but they're nothing until I add captions to them.
Yes.
Because that's the kind of egotist he is, you know?
Yes,
like,
that's how Stan is. I don't think Stan.
No, I agree that Kirby is making the stories. I just think that's how Stan would look at it.
I don't think Stan is Bob Kane. I think Bob Kane does what you're talking about, right? With Kane and Finger, Bob Kane is stealing consciously. I don't think Stan ever did that. I think Stan believed that he was writing things.
I think Stan is like deluded, which is like a different kind of evil. But yeah.
This is a weird conversation to get into at the end of the episode.
This is my fault for bringing it up.
And it's hard because we know so many backstories because we study this for a living, right? But like, I do think it is an important historic document to have. Okay, no matter how you want to put it, these are the two most important figures in Marvel, period. However you feel about Stan, however you feel about Jack, they're certainly the two most important figures in their history. One of them died, and I think it is important to have the thoughts recorded of the surviving one and the memory of his friend, however imperfect they are. Is that fair? I think it's important to look at this is how Stan wanted it remembered.
Well.
Even if it's icky. I mean, I get why it's icky, right?
I take your perspective. I don't see it that way. There's too much intent in the rethoric to me.
Okay. I think John brought it up. I'm curious where you're at with it too.
I agree with Andrew. I just think that Stan believes his own bullshit.
that's where I'm at. I think Stan absolutely believes everything that he says.
Anyway, John, did you have thoughts about it?
After listening to that, I would say that this is Stan's public statement on behalf of Marvel Comics. And that will color it in certain ways.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I would prefer him to speak to Jack as a person. Had a friendship, like some story anecdotes from that of how Jack behaved and how he was as a person, rather than he was a great illustrator. We know that. I would like some insight into Jack that we wouldn't get from the comic book page.
And that's a really good point, John, because I think that supports Andrew's argument, because like, if Stan's writing about it from a business perspective, he can't say Jack is the co-creator because he needs to assert ownership over the stuff, because there were like active lawsuits going on at various times throughout this history. So that does support your point, Andrew.
Yeah.
But it sort of reminds me of the Costanza thing from Seinfeld, where it's like, not a lie if you believe it. You know, right. that's my reading of Stan.
And it's just, and it's weird because the same thing, he's the same way when talking about Ditko later. It's so weird every time Stan talked. But like when you're talking about, like, you know, it would be great to hear some personal anecdotes in a eulogy rather than, and then he drew Captain America, right? Like, I don't know that Stan had personal anecdotes in that world because by this time, Stanley Lieber has lived and breathed being Stan Lee for like 40 something years at this point, and he's just on all the time, and I don't know that there's much distinction between the character and the man anymore. There certainly wasn't later, so we are weirdly psychoanalyzing Stanley.
I was just writing about Mr. Miracle last week, so I read the Funky Flashman parody recently and all those things. Anyway, a topic for another time.
Well, but I was going to say, Stan's eulogy of Jack is not going to make mention of the fourth world, right? Because I don't think Jack saw things this way. And I think that was sort of the problem. Not because, like, I think the problem was that Jack understood Stan's delusion. And Jack's like, I'm a writer and I'm going to go do that.
I just want to mention real quick, on the border of the bullet bulletin, they list several of the characters that Kirby created as part of the Kirby legacy, and they do include Darkseid. Now, that Stan went and have decided that. That was some other editor who's laying this out.
Yep, there he is.
That's interesting.
I see it in the very bottom on the left. That's interesting. Wow. Never noticed that.
That is interesting. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, other final thoughts. Mav, you get to throw a final thought in here if you would like.
I mean, if you're a fan of, you know, X-Men comics to this day, this is where all the Phalanx technocracy stuff really, really starts. For better or worse, that's...
Yep.
You're seeing it. I don't think the story is worth getting into in this issue, but you know,
yeah, we didn't even talk about Zero, but we're gonna be talking way more about the Phalanx.
Right, all this stuff with Zero in here, it matters, and it continues to matter 30 years later, so something. It's never been my favorite thing. Yeah,
we have a couple of guests who do want to talk about Doug Locke, so I am looking forward to some of those conversations. My one final thought was just about the portrayal of Kid Nightcrawler in general, but also the Ken Lashley splash page, the pinup at the end of him and the butterfly, because I really want to like this. But, and we've said some very nice things about Lashley, in previous episodes. I think we've been very kind to his artwork, but superhero artists can't draw children, and it is so uncanny valley and creepy, and the proportions are weird, and that image gives me nightmares. It's in Homestar Runner world, where there's this creepy painting in Strong Bad's closet that gives Strong Bad the Ghiblis. That picture of Nightcrawler with the butterfly gives me the Ghiblis. That's the one hiding in my closet that throws me into a hysterical state. There's just something weird about that image. I don't know. John, coming to you to wrap up this conversation, anything that you would like to talk about in closing that we didn't get a chance?
Well, you brought up Ken Lashley's art, and I will say I like how he draws Kurt's hair. It's not an easy hairdo to draw, and I think it works very effectively here.
I always appreciate any time someone actually tries to draw it curly rather than just drawing it like he clearly ran a straightening iron through a Jennifer Aniston style, so I do appreciate that as well.
Staying. There's a meeting of the round table.
No, I can't.
All right, we will wrap things up there, other than to say, John, thank you so much again for joining us. We had a blast talking Lil Kurt with you, and we need to remind our lovely listeners of what you get up to and where they can find you. So any books, writing, podcasts you would like them to check out, please remind them to do so.
Yes, please check out the Protagonist podcast. I am an occasional guest there. It's hosted by my brother, by my brother Jeff, who's a previous guest on this show, and I've actually been featured quite a bit in the last month or so. Mm-hmm. So you can certainly find me easily enough. The submissions for Popular Culture Association are open, and if you want to come talk comics and comics art, you're welcome to submit there. And also, my brother Joseph and I are going to be co-editing a volume for McFarlane Press on monsters and adaptation.
Ooh.
The call for papers for that should be up by the time this episode drops. Look for Monsters with a Thousand Faces is the working title right now. I'm looking a broad perspective on this. I want lots of different types of adaptation, not just literature to film or literature to comic books. If you want to do something with video games, that might get moved up the pile for potential publication. I'm also really interested in international approach, not just the Euro-American stories, but getting outside of that and looking at other types of monsters and various types of adaptation. So if you wanted to do the Japanese or Korean drama adaptation of a webtoon, that might get pushed up the pile. On the other hand, if you wanted to do Ahab the Mutant Hunter as a adaptation of Moby Dick, we would certainly consider it.
Well, I was going to say, we better make sure that that CFP gets in front of previous guest Kate Coker, because that sounds very much like something that she would be interested in. But yeah, if it's out when the episode drops, we'll certainly add it to the show notes and retweet it. So yeah, thank you just so much again for joining us, John. That book sounds awesome.
Thank you.
Next, some old friends come back in new shapes in Excalibur number 78, Fire in the Wild, featuring the more substantial debut of Doug Locke. In the meantime, if you liked what you heard, please follow us, like, and review the podcast wherever you're listening to it or watching it. Don't forget to check out the fabulous YouTube videos we've done for many of our earlier episodes, which you can find via our website or the Vox Popcast YouTube channel. As always, if you want to chat with us about Excalibur or pitch yourself as a guest for a future episode, let us know. You can find us via our website, goshgollywow.com, where we've got some fun extras, and at the time of this recording anyway, you can find us on Twitter at GoshGollyWow, where we post daily pages from whatever issue we're reading that week and more fun extras. We are staying on Twitter until it officially collapses. We will see what happens. Thank you, Andrew and Mav. Yeah, I know. Thank you, Andrew and Mav, for another wholesome family reunion. Thank you, John, for going home with us. Thank you all for listening. And a special thanks to Maximilian of Thoughtform Music for our truly epic theme song. Play us out.